Gomez from EPFL is going to tell us about bootstrapping scattering amplitudes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here. It's always great to come back to PI, see some of our old friends. So here, this talk is going to be essentially some summary, some review of our recent efforts to revive this old program of the S-matrix bootstrap that was popular in the 60s. So these are my collaborators. John Toledo is actually here. So you can ask him about our ongoing efforts to describe this multiple amplitude bootstrap in 2D, which I will just briefly mention at the end of the talk. So the outline of my talk is here. So I will start with a longer than usual introduction just to try to bring everyone to the same page. And then I'll describe the simplest case where we do scattering in 1+1 dimensions, where we can actually solve the problem analytically. And then I'll explain how to devise a numerical algorithm that can allow us to also study the problem in higher dimensions. And then this is going to be rather brief, I think. I'm going to explain what we are doing at the moment, which is study several scattering amplitudes together and imposing all the joint consistency conditions. OK, so let me then start with the introduction. So the idea here is really just to study quantum field theory. Okay, I guess that's the universal language of this workshop. So that's the goal, is to study quantum field theory. But in particular, I want to study quantum field theory non-perturbatively and on the continuum, okay? Which is perhaps less common to many of you. Okay? So, okay, non-perturbative is obviously, right? We are interested in strongly coupled theories where perturbation theory is not really a useful description. This part is perhaps a bit more controversial. Why do I care about the continuum? But in fact, even condensed matter people, I mean, they study the system on the lattice, but then they tune to the critical point, they try to take the continuum limit, and they're only interested in universal quantities, which are actually independent of the particular microscopic realization. So my point of view here is that quantum field theory is actually a mathematical structure that exists in the continuum, makes sense in the continuum, and we should be able to study it as it is, not with some approximation of breaking it into small pieces, like Archimedes measuring the area of the circle by approximating with polygons or something. Okay? So that's the goal. And this, if you want, this approach to quantum field theory goes by the name of bootstrap, or at least that's what we like to call it, if it's completely universally accepted name. But so in this approach, what we do is we basically, what we do is just study the space of all quantum field theories. So the goal is not to study a particular theory, but to study the space of quantum field theories. So there's some space. Well, it doesn't have to be connected. Some space. I don't know what it is. And how do we get this space, or at least how do we get some boundaries of this space? We just impose consistency conditions, okay, on physical observables, renormalized observables, already physical observables. OK, so this is very vague. So to give you a more concrete picture of what I mean by that, let me just briefly review our main inspiration for this project, which is the success story of the recent years of the conformal bootstrap. So let me just spend a few minutes, because I think, or I know that some of you are not aware of this, maybe the majority is. Okay? So here, it's a particular case of this story, where instead of studying a generic quantum field theory, we study a smaller class, which is conformal invariant quantum field theory. Okay? So I will just describe for you the simplest example where how this works, so that you have a more precise idea or what this picture of consistency conditions giving you a space of theories means in practice. So take a CFT in three dimensions, a conformal field theory in three dimensions with a Z2 symmetry, okay? And consider the four-point function of the operator, which I call sigma, which is the operator which is Z2 odd, which is the lowest dimension. If you want the lightest operator, which is Z2 odd. Okay? So this is a physical observable. It's a four-point function in this 3D conformal field theory. So it has to satisfy several consistency conditions. So I'll just gonna list some of them. So the first one, of course, it has to be conformally symmetric. So that tells you that it cannot depend on the positions of the points in the arbitrary fraction. It has to preserve conformal invariance. And the most important constraint is that it has to be consistent with the operator product expansion. Okay? So to be more explicit, so if you take this local operator and you take a product of two of them, you can expand in a sum of operators. So in this case, you get just this would be the first term, the contribution of the identity when the two operators come close together. And then you have corrections corresponding to other operators, for example, x to the delta epsilon, where epsilon is the first Z2 even operator. Okay? Of course, this is sigma sigma, so Z2 odd, you only see Z2 even operator. Okay? So more systematically, if you have this four-point function of the sigma fields, you can use the operator product expansion between the first two and the second two operators, and you get a particular expansion. So I don't know, let me just write it like that. So let's say this is the first two operators, and you have an expansion where you have the OP coefficients sigma sigma say k operator k, and you sum over, let me call it just O, and you sum over the operators O that are exchanged in this the square of the OP coefficient, because you have to take the OP coefficient twice. And of course, you can also take the operator product expansion a different way, which I'll just schematically write here like that. Okay. And this should be compatible. You should get the same four-point function using the different operator product expansions. So this is the main equation consistency condition that this four-point function has to satisfy. Okay. I'm running out of space, but just to put it together, of course, there's also unitarity, which is usually imposed in this game. So, okay, just unitarity imposes some constraints on the scaling dimensions, but also more importantly, it imposes that all of these OP coefficients are real. Okay? So you can choose some basis of operators where all the OP coefficients are real. Okay?
Sorry. Is it obvious that the two operators that run in the two channels are the same?
You're summing on
overall. I mean, you're summing overall, and but it's the same OP. I mean, it's the same field. It's sigma sigma or sigma sigma. So it's really the same. You're just changing the kinematics. So this. It's the same OPE, it's just this function is different because you're permuting points.
But those operators depend on coordinates, right, of sigmas.
These operators depend.
Yeah, well, on the right-hand side, I mean.
On the right-hand side is this symbol, yeah, which is called the conformal block that depends on the position. So this depends on the points xi. And this and that are just related by permuting the position.
What do you know about convergence with OPE?
The OPE... Well, depends how you... There are several types of... If you just want this convergence of this series of powers, okay, so this power series where you don't split operators, primaries and descendants, which are different types of operators under this conformal symmetry, then it's just within a circle, if you want a ball, whose radius is the next operator, the closest operator in the correlation form. But in fact, if you regroup your operators into conformal families, is what is being done here implicitly, then these functions are already conformal blocks. They encode the contribution of primary and all of its descendants. Then this sum, it's only over primaries, and this sum converges in the entire Euclidean plane.
Can I just ask, just to make sure I understand, that last line for the four-point function, that operator O includes the identity, the first term, and the
It does. Okay, so, I mean, this is not the topic of my talk, so I won't give you the details how to turn this set of consistency conditions into actual a numerical algorithm. So essentially you take this equation and you take some truncated version of this equation and you put it on a computer. I will just draw for you the basic results so that you get a picture of this space in this concrete case. So if you draw the scaling dimensions of these two fields, the first Z2 odd and the first Z2 even. So we are in 3D, so the free fields start at a half, and then the square would be at one. So you get some curve like that, okay? Where all of this region is excluded. In the sense, when I say excluded, it's incompatible with those equations. You impose those equations, you exclude this region, and you find this feature, which most of you saw where if you know about the Ising model, the critical exponents, this is precisely the location of the 3D Ising model. Okay. And in fact, this was the old story from, I don't know, almost 10 years ago, or maybe 8 years ago. But more recently, if you study also more four-point functions, like this one, if you study this full system of four-point functions, then actually you get something like that. So all this is excluded too. So you get some two disconnected regions which are allowed, this region here and a tiny island around the Ising theory, and actually this shrinks with the numerical precision, and that gives you the biggest precision in the critical exponents of the 3D Ising model. So that's the success story in conformal field theory. Is
some sense of what these equations look like? Are they just algebraic equations, series of coupled algebraic equations? Or what are they? And you solve them numerically, or what?
So these equations is what's done in practice. You take this equation. This equation is valid for all values of the positions. So what you calculate this in a particular configuration is actually like a square configuration of the points, and you take derivatives around this square. And so you take n derivatives, you Taylor expand around this square. And then you keep, say, n derivatives around this square position, and that n is the truncation level. So if you take that n to infinity, this size of this island seems to be shrinking to zero. I mean, of course, n is always finite in the computer.
And then it's just coupled algebraic equations for those Taylor coefficients?
I mean, this is still an infinite series, so you cannot just solve for the coefficients. but it defines you some kind of positive semi-definite. I mean, this is a these are things are positive by unitarity, so it's like a cone. It's a sum of positive vectors. Okay. So now the goal of this talk is, what about, what if we are off criticality? So what if you take you take your action and you go to this CFT, but then you deform away, I don't know, let's say in this Ising, you are off the critical temperature, so you deform by this energy density. So how do we bootstrap this quantum field theory? Okay. So now this quantum field theory is massive. So it has a mass gap, it has a finite correlation length. How do we bootstrap its particle content and its scattering amplitudes of the particles there? Okay, so we asked ourselves this question. This works so well, perhaps there should be something similar to be done here. And so we thought, okay, we can look at the four-point function. It's a mess. Okay? Once you break scale invariance, the four-point function here was a function of two variables, just two cross ratios. But here, it's a function of six distances. It's like, okay, that's too many variables for me to work on. So you can try other things. The most natural thing, at least to my knowledge, is to analyze the scattering amplitude of the actual lightest particle in this quantum field theory. Okay? So that leads to this S matrix bootstrap. And just to set up the basic problem I will discuss, so the basic setup that I will discuss is the following. So let's consider a quantum field theory. And let's think of its mass spectrum. So I will have the vacuum, and I will have the lightest particle. We'll have mass m. And then above 2m, I have a two-particle continuum. I can have any invariant mass. And then I will also allow for an extra particle of mass mb. Well, if you want, you can think of it as some bound state, but that's just a name. And now the observable that's going to play the role of the four-point function is going to be this scattering amplitude, 2 to 2 scattering amplitude of this lightest particle. Okay. So I will assume relativistic invariance. So these are momentum p1, p2, p3, p4. So all the momenta are on shell. Right? These are just on-shell particles that are scattering. And so this scattering amplitude will only be a function of the Mandelstam invariance S, T, and U. The usual ones. And of course, S, T, and U are not all independent. S plus T plus U satisfy the usual constraint of being 4m squared. Okay, so that's the basic observable and the basic variables. And now, this is one of the questions I will focus on. There's other questions you can ask, but if you have this mass spectrum, then this scattering amplitude, when the variable S approaches mb squared, we'll have a pole, right? We'll have a factorization pole. And I will call this residue the square of the cubic coupling. Okay, so you should think of this pictorially as coming from this diagram, where I have here mb being the exchange, and I have two cubic couplings, gb, gb. Okay? You should not think of this as a Feynman diagram. Okay, this is completely a non-perturbative statement. I'm just defining the cubic coupling as the residue of this scattering amplitude at mb squared. Okay?
What analyticity are you assuming about the S matrix?
I will, I'll assume Mandelsam analyticity, like most of it, but I will explain that in detail. Okay, and so if you want the plots we are going to do, we're going to study the space of possibilities. So in particular, I'm going to try to maximize this cubic coupling given this mass spectrum.
Okay. Claiming that mass spectrum exists for the Ising model or 3D?
So this one, I mean, this is the first, the simplest case. So actually, we will see a connection with the Ising model in 2D. But that has more particles, with the Ising model actually deformed by magnetic field. I mean, if you just deform by this, you just have a free massive fermion, right? So you have trivial scattering. But,
you're deforming by something.
No. This was an example. I'm not gonna really try to connect with 3D Ising. Okay. I mean, any CST deformed by relevant operators defines this some quantum field theory, and I mean that's just the simplest setup. Yeah. Maybe this was a bit misleading. Yeah. No, I'm not gonna try to connect with 3D Ising of criticality.
Mm-hmm. Can you repeat the motivation for maximizing the?
Well, the obvious motivation is because I can. It's one of the non-perturbative parameters. I have masses and I have these couplings. So this is, if you want, coordinates in the space of quantum field theories. So I want to find boundaries. If you really think about this, another way to find the Ising model is to maximize the OP coefficient of the stress tensor. So like OPE maximization of this OP coefficient is also a useful game to play in conformal bootstrap. So a natural thing to ask here. But if you want some intuition why this is expected to be finite, to exist a maximum value, you can think that, I mean, that is this diagram, but there's also this diagram, right? When you exchange like that in the T-channel. And so this generates you an attractive interaction between the lightest particle. And so if this coupling is very, very strong, you expect more bound states. But you are saying they do not exist because we fixed the mass spectrum.
But this bound state has no width. You're assuming it's stable.
It's below 2m, so it cannot decay. Yeah. Well, it cannot decay. Okay, so this is the general setup. Now let me try to be really concrete. So let me study 2D. So in 2D, this problem actually can as an analytic solution. So let's just go through that so that we understand exactly how it works, and then the numerics will be simple to understand. So the great simplification in 2D is that there is no scattering angle, right? You only have forward or backward scattering. So in terms of the invariance, that just means that either U is zero or T is zero. So it means that this scattering amplitude, which I'll call S, is really just a function of the center of mass energy. It's only a function of a single variable. And now, let's try to impose then the several consistency conditions. Okay. So maybe I can do it here. So the first consistency condition is crossing symmetry. So crossing symmetry is just a statement that this function is invariant if you interchange S with T, which 4m squared minus s is just this reflection that follows from this. Let's say if you take u to be zero in this two dimension, then s plus 2 is 4m squared. So this is the crossing symmetry that you have. So that's the first property that you know. The second property is what Matt was asking about, is analyticity. So, first of all, there's real analyticity. So S of as complex conjugate is just a full function, complex conjugated. And in the complex plane of S, what you see is that you have cuts associated with the continuous, with the two-particle continuum. So they start at 4m squared. And because of this crossing symmetry, you have another cut starting at zero and going the other way around. And then you have poles associated with these stable particles that can be exchanged. So you have this pole at mb squared, which you want is associated with this S-channel exchange. And then you have a pole at crossed pole at m 4m squared minus mb squared, which is associated with this exchange. And in general, you would expect another pole at m squared, because you could also have a pole of the particle itself being exchanged. But so we are, at, in this simplest setting, we are excluding that coupling. Okay, so there's no cubic coupling between the particle itself. Okay? Imagine the particle has some odd and there's some Z2 symmetry or something. We exclude this coupling. But I mean, that's just for simplicity. OK, and that's it. The final consistency condition that we impose is unitarity. And so what is unitarity? Unitarity is just conservation of probability. So you should take this amplitude, and you take its modulus square. That's a probability of going from two particles to the same two particles. So that's at most one. But this is true only for the physical process. So it's only true if S is bigger than 4n squared, which means that, I mean, this condition means that I'm measuring just above this cut, right? The physical scattering amplitude is this analytic function evaluated just above the cut.
Why isn't it equal to
1? It would be equal to 1. Strictly speaking, it would be equal to 1 up to the next cut. Because, so let's say this cut is when you can start going. So this is to even. So you would go to, I don't know, like mb plus m. Square.
Or 4mb square, no?
4mb square.
If you don't have the trilinear coupling.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. You're right. The next threshold, 4mb square. So what I'm saying is that there is a range where the only possibility for these two particles is to go to the same two particles. But after that, you can either go to a different two particles or to go to many particle states, right? There's many, many thresholds that open. And so that's why I'm writing this inequality. There's just a small range of energy where this is actually saturated. Okay. Okay. Any question about the problem, the setup? OK, so now it's, you see, it's really a well-defined mathematical problem. Take a function with this analytic structure and this symmetry. Its modulus is bounded on these cuts. And you want to find the function with the maximum residue at these poles. That's a very clean mathematical problem, so clean that it's been solved more than 40 years ago by Michael Kreutz. So the solution I will write, and then I'll explain why this is the right solution. So the solution is like that. So it's only a function of this crossing invariant, okay? S for n. And then I put here plus and I put here minus. And here I put exactly the square root such that it has a pole at mb square. Okay, and this is the same square root, but with a plus sign. Okay. So I claim this is the optimal S that solves this problem, that has the maximum cubic coupling, the maximum residue. And you see, the most important property that you should see from here is that this optimal solution actually saturates unitarity, so it's exactly, it's a pure phase for, I mean, on top of the cut. So that's not easy to see, because basically this square root becomes imaginary, and this is real, so this is really the ratio of two complex numbers. Complex number, it's complex conjugate. But, okay, this, if you want, like that, it's just a guess. But if you want the argument, the rigorous argument why this is the optimal solution, it's also very simple. So let's just define the ratio of the function we were looking for by my guess. Okay? So this function is analytic on the entire plane minus the cut, right? So it's analytic on the entire domain. On the domain, which is equal, if you want, the complex plane minus the cut, or the cuts, the two cuts. You see, because this function had some poles, but I'm dividing by the same poles, so it doesn't have any poles inside. But moreover, this function is on the boundary of the domain. This function h of s, the modulus is bounded by 1 on the boundary of the domain. Because this one has modulus 1, and this was bounded by 1. Okay? So then you have a function. And what we are looking for, right? What we'd like to maximize is the residue of this, which is just given by the value of h at mb square. I mean, okay, it's proportional. So max of the residue of S at S equals mb square is equal, or it's proportional to that. Okay? Then I just, this residue is what it is, and I need to maximize that one. But clearly, this function, okay, this function is analytic. This modulus is bounded by 1 on the boundary, so the biggest it can be inside is 1. This is the, well, it goes by the name of maximum modulus principle. The maximum of the modulus of an analytic function is always attained at the boundary of the domain. Okay, so this was a small.
So the max of gb squared is 1?
No, the max, sorry, I should have.
Which residue is that?
It's this factor here. So
sorry, that's just a proportional.
Yeah, I should put, it's the residue of this S matrix. I just have to take the residue of that. So now I'll show you the plot. Okay. This was just to prove that this was the optimal S matrix. Now I have the optimal S matrix, I just take the residue and plot it. Okay, so now I think I will move to the projector to show you some plots.
So
I like
that naive thing. All the square roots are triangular function, basically. This
triangular function.
Yeah, decay momentum. If you have a decay momentum, you know, Schelling function, decay momentum. If you have a particle which decays into two particles,
mm-hmm.
This particle has s. And the two final particles are mm. You want to compute the kinematical decay momentum. It's exactly s minus 4 m squared. It's exactly the square root of s times s minus 4 m squared. And then all those terms are repeated in your optimal function. And there's just a minus sign in the Chalin function. So where does it come from? I don't see it immediately.
Well,
of course,
perhaps there's a deeper reason, but I mean, you see, there's not, once you, it should be Lorentz invariant, so it should be a function of S, and should be crossing symmetric, so you have to put S and form M square minus S. So then there's not much freedom. But perhaps
like
there's...
when you go to close to threshold, you open the phase space.
Yeah, exactly, this factor.
And so those are just decay momenta close to where you open the phase space. But there must be some easy way to see it, because it's exactly the same function.
I mean, it's true, because you take this function and you can compute this imaginary part, and here it has to be compatible with this phase space, and so these square roots are not there.
They're not there by chance.
By chance, yeah, exactly. Okay. So all of this is blah blah, I told you. In great detail. There it is. Okay. So what you get if you plot this residue, so this what I call GB square, you get this graph. So below this curve are all the allowed quantum field theories, and above there's no consistent quantum field theory. And okay, there is some feature. So for example, here the coupling goes to zero when the mass of the exchange particle approaches the two-particle threshold. So this actually can be studied with some normativistic limit. And then there is also this very obvious feature, is that this bound diverges. So the maximum goes to infinity when the mass of the exchange particle goes to square root 2. But that you can see in this picture. You see when mb square goes to 2 m square, these two poles collide. But these two poles have opposite residue, because one pole is in S and the other one is in 4 m square minus S. So they essentially cancel. And so that's why the residue is unbounded, because they are just fighting each other. Okay.
So the red dots are numerical points?
Yes, the red dots are numerical points. Yes. But
the reason why it's numerics, since you have an ID expression for that?
These red dots are actually numerical points obtained by studying this coming from two-dimensional anti de Sitter space and taking the flat space limit. It's a different story. It's a related, but not important for this problem.
Exactly. But what's the analytic expression for the residue? Because you can just compute it, not from the form.
Yes. I didn't write it here, but yeah, you can just. Why do you?
No, just for curiosity. You're saying the divergence square root of 2 is due to the two poles coming together.
Yeah, it's when they come together. Yes. Yes. And in fact, in this case, this bound, or at least part of this bound, is actually saturated. So this S matrix is actually an S matrix of a quantum field theory of the Sein-Gordon theory when you scatter the lightest breather. At this branch, so up to MB bigger than square root 2. Then this side, we don't know any physical system that actually maximizes, that realizes this optimal S matrix. But on this side, this actually is saturated. And as I told you, so this saturates two-particle unitarity. So at any energy you send two particles, you always get two particles, the same two particles. So that's what you expect in an integrable theory. And so that's why you get Sein-Gordon. It's an integrable theory, so it's a consistent. You get our bounds are saturated by an integrable theory. OK?
You know what the theory is on the other side?
No. Here. Actually, I don't think there is a theory that saturates this bound. But
and in fact, if you extrapolate below one, since in your derivation it was never important that MB was bigger than M, no?
No, it is, right? If below one, No, you are right, sorry. The low one I can go. That is, at some point I cannot go, because if the external particle is not the lightest particle, then you start having anomalous thresholds. You start having Landau diagrams, that you start having extra singularities beyond the singularities that you just get from the spectrum. I can draw you something. So there are Landau diagrams, for example, like that. Sorry. So this would be the external particle of mass m, and then if mb is smaller, I guess, than 1 over square root 2, then you can draw a diagram where all the internal propagators are on shell, and so this gives you extra singularities which are not described just by this. So there's the analytic structure becomes more complicated. So that's why we want m to be the lightest particle. That simplifies our life.
In this case, can you calculate the S matrix for 4 points that aren't all just M as external legs? Do you get
if you put different masses?
Yeah, I mean for the Stein-Gordon matrix, guys, if you know the theories, you can calculate them. But
sure, yes, you can also get bounds by putting different masses. So now we are looking at this multiple amplitude. So we're looking at two stable particles and all the 2-2-2 scattering amps involving these two particles. Well, our goal is really to look at the full set together, but we can also look at a subset, like say particle 1 scattering with particle 2 and going again to particle 1 and particle 2, and that also gives you some bounds on some coupling. So yeah, it's not the strongest, but already. Okay, so let me. So this is just a plot to entertain you. So you can now do exactly the same by changing the spectrum and putting more stable particles. So here we did just this plot for the maximum cubic coupling if you allow 3 stable particles. And I'm just showing it to you because there is again a known integrable theory, which is the Ising field theory deformed by magnetic field. So this is an integrable theory, this EA theory of Zamolodchikov, where we know the exact S matrix, and the exact S matrix is the one that maximizes this cubic coupling between the lightest particle. But unfortunately, these surfaces of maximum cubic coupling are quite smooth, and there's nothing particularly special that happens at this point where the theory is. So there's no kink there, unfortunately. Okay. Okay, I'm being, I think, too slow. So let me explain you how to go to higher dimensions. So to go to higher dimensions, we first are going to solve this problem numerically. And because the analytic solution does not generalize to higher dimensions, but this numerical solution that I'm going to present now generalizes to higher dimensions. Okay? So the basic trick is extremely simple. So what we do is just do a conformal mapping of the complex plane, the S plane minus this cut from 4m squared to infinity, to the unit disk. Okay? There's even here a formula, you can do this mapping. So we call this variable rho of S. So rho lives in the unit disk. And when rho takes values inside this unit disk, S covers the full complex plane. And the top of the cut goes to the bottom, to the top part of the unit disk, and the bottom to the bottom part of the unit disk. Okay? So this just opens this cut into this unit disk.
What about the cut at 1? At 0?
So I'm not. Yeah, I'll explain that next. So this just works with one cut at a time. Okay. So now, what we do to solve that problem is that we actually extend. Okay. So here, the actual physical amplitude is a function of a single variable, s. But it has this symmetry, s to 4m squared minus s. So what we're going to do is we're going to extend the function to a function of two variables, two complex variables, s and t, independent. And so there's a pole in s, there's a pole in t. And besides this pole, the function will be analytic inside the s disk and inside the t disk. Okay? And so we write a Taylor series in the corresponding row variables because the function is analytic inside the disk, so this Taylor series converges. And then when we compute the physical amplitude, in particular, if we want to impose unitarity, we take this extended function of two variables and we evaluate it when t is 4m squared minus s.
Can I ask you a question? I'm a little confused about what happens at s equal infinity, meaning I might still have a discontinuity across the cut at infinity, which in the raw disk would
cause... So s equals infinity is mapped to this point.
Yes, and I'm saying I could have a discontinuity, you know, in going through that point, not quite at the boundary.
So...
Because crossing the cut at s equal infinity can still be a discontinuous thing, no?
Right, but I'm not saying that that this point is regular. I mean, it's regular inside the disk. I can have singularities at the boundary.
I guess I'm confused by the picture, perhaps. Meaning, there is no obvious sense in which I can go around the cut at s equal infinity.
Ah, okay. So this picture here, yeah. But you see here, that's not happening.
Well, it's kind of happening, you know, because you're going from blue to red, slightly inside the boundary.
I think you're saying that because you are thinking about both cuts, right? There's a cut in S that goes to infinity, and then the crossed cut that goes to infinity the other side, right? But here, that's the point of this extension. I'm really separating the two cuts. Okay? You can think of this as some kind of, you can also derive this kind of expression from dispersion relation, right? So you would write the function as a sum of the poles plus the contribution of the S cut plus the contribution of the T cut, okay? So this is another way of doing that. If you want, it's a bit more general. I mean, you don't have to worry about subtractions or anything like that, but it's equivalent to that. Okay, so now the numerical game is very simple. So I just take these ansatz. It has some coefficients, gb square and cabs, okay? So this should be some symmetric in the indices to make crossing symmetry. And I just impose unitarity numerically. So to make this numerically feasible, of course, this sum has to be truncated. So I put here some maximal number of this Taylor expansion. So I have a finite number of variables. And then I take this unitarity constraint, and I also evaluate it at some finite number of values of S. Okay? If you want, I take some grid in S, and I turn this into a finite number of constraints.
Sorry, what are the rows? The row S and row T?
Yeah, this is this map. So S and row S.
So that you compute at S and compute at T?
Yeah, exactly. So row is a function of S that, given any point on this complex plane, rho will give inside this unit disk. So I'll use the variable rho because then I can just write a Taylor expansion in powers of rho.
Okay, so A and B is the powers.
A and B are the powers, yes. Perfect. This is just rho of S raised to the power A and rho of T raised to the power B.
You have to choose some S0.
I have to choose some S0. That's a freedom of which point I map to the origin here. S naught is the origin here. There's a freedom in the conformal mapping. I can, like, if I want more precision close to threshold, or yeah, that's the results don't depend on that. Okay.
And this S up to S, these discrete values of S they take are complex, right?
So the discrete values of S are real, are here on top of the cut. They correspond to values of rho, which are at the boundary of the disk. That's where we impose unitarity, right? It's on top of the cut, corresponds to the boundary of the disk. That's where unitarity is imposed. Okay, so this, I mean, for this case, I won't even show you results. It just works, matches precisely the, if you put n of order 10, 20, it already converges very well. These constraints, You can put order 10, 50, it doesn't change the result. It just converges very well to the analytic solution, okay? This parameterization. So I should emphasize that we use exactly the same numerical algorithm for semi-definite programming that David Simons often developed for the conformal bootstrap. So we are really following the spirit of the bootstrap. Okay, any question about this? So now it's very easy to generalize to higher dimensions. So in higher dimensions, what changes? So we have this scattering amplitude. Now it's a function of, well, if you have three variables with a constraint, that s plus t plus u is equal to 4m squared. So again, we're going to write a full extension, a function of three variables with poles plus a Taylor series in the three disks. And then the physical amplitude is just when we evaluate that, when s plus t plus u is equal to 4m squared. So the only difference here is that to impose unitarity, the full power of two-particle unitarity is imposed better when you move to partial waves. So we take this scattering amplitude and we compute each partial amplitude, so for each angular momentum L. Well, for identical particles, L will just be even, but we'll have for each L, so we just integrate the scattering amplitude against some Legendre polynomial, or more generally, some Gegenbauer polynomial. And that's it. That's your, if you want, the exponential of the phase shift, if you want. And then each one of these partial amplitudes must satisfy unitarity, exactly as before. Okay? So, but the difficulty here is that each partial amplitude is indeed just a function of S and satisfies unitarity. But crossing symmetry is not simple at the level of partial amplitudes. Crossing symmetry is simple at the level of T. So that's why the problem doesn't have an analytic solution, or at least I don't know how to solve it analytically, because crossing symmetry and unitarity are very hard to put in the same variable. Okay? But okay, now since you have that, again, you do exactly the same thing. Truncate, okay? So we have finite number of variables, so we just compute these integrals, and we evaluate them in some grids, and for values of L from 0 up to L max. So again, we have quadratic constraints on a finite number of variables, so this is a very efficient algorithm to implement, just maximize g squared subject to this constraint. And that's what you get. So what do I need to tell you? So this is done with a truncation on the spin up to 20. So we imposed unitarity up to spin 20. So this, we checked that at least for these values of n max, so recall that n max is the order of the Taylor series, how many terms you keep in your Taylor series. This L max is sufficient, so if we increase L max, we don't see any change in this plot. Okay? And what you see is that, for example, let me show you first this branch here. As you increase your number of parameters, as you increase your parameters in your Taylor series, you are able to achieve a higher cubic coupling. So you have more freedom in your ansatz, so naturally you're able to achieve a higher cubic coupling. But on this side of the plot, so for mass of the exchange particle bigger than square root 2, you see that the curves basically don't change. So it's already very well converged. So this really, we think it's the optimal value. This side, they are still moving, so I mean, we can extrapolate to something near that, but not it's converging more slowly. But this side, it's very well. And we observe, again, a maximum close to this point of mb equals square root 2. But now here, we think this is a finite value. It's not diverging. And I mean, the argument that here allow it to diverge is that these two poles just collide. Doesn't work here anymore because now it's not just a single variable function. I mean, there's a... Well, if you look at a single partial wave, let's put it like that, the S channel pole will just give a pole in the spin zero partial wave, but the T channel pole will actually give a cut because you have to integrate against the Gegenbauer polynomial. So it's really a much more complicated analytic structure.
And the fact that it's not exactly a two is also
I think it's going to be a two, right? Because you see here, this is still going up, and at the same time, it's moving there. So
the fact that it's at two when the two collapse is still true, no?
This guy is still here. This guy is, if this becomes, say, the spin zero partial amplitude, then you have a cut starting from here going there. It's no longer a pole. But yeah, the position of the beginning of the cut is the same. How much time do I have?
Maybe 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Okay, so that's what we get. So I think this I will skip. So you see, this is just one question that we decided to ask, maximize a cubic coupling. Another question you can ask, and we have asked, is maximize what you can call a quartic coupling. So take a theory that doesn't have any poles. So, I mean, you can think of, for example, pi zero scattering. So there is no exchange stable particle. So there's only the cuts that can appear. And so you can define some kind of quartic coupling by the amplitude, the value of the amplitude at this crossing symmetric point. And then you can say, well, how big can this be compatible with again, unitarity, crossing symmetry, and all that? And okay, we got some number. Let me perhaps just show you this final result. So I don't know. In those units, it's like, you see, it's very, very well converged, 2.66. Okay. And if I show you here, there was earlier results from the 70s, and people found this value by some explicit construction, but with less parameters. And this value was an exact upper bound. So our result, optimal result, falls here in the middle. Sorry, I'm not explaining this properly. So these dots are from bad convergent numerics. Then if you improve our ansatz, you get better numerics, and we get better. But let me not explain that in detail. So we can also study like scattering lengths, things like that. So basically, the idea is that you have these consistency conditions. Now you can ask physical parameters, what is the allowed range compatible with this consistency? And in fact, I would like your suggestions for what are the natural and interesting questions to ask to perhaps find something more interesting. So an important comment is that even in higher dimensions, the optimal numerical S matrix that we are finding seem to saturate two-particle unitarity. So you should look here at the scale. So it's already very close to one, okay? Very zoomed close to one. So the modulus of this spin zero partial amplitude, it's almost one all the way. This is like this is running from 0 to pi going above this unit disk. So this is running energy from 4m squared to infinity. And you see that as you increase n max, you get better and better unitarity saturation. Okay? So this, my interpretation of this is quite pessimistic, is that the optimal S matrices are actually never realized because they are very non-physical. They don't have any particle production. Okay? And with, at least I don't expect to have higher dimensional theories which don't have any particle production and they are interacting. Okay? I think this is not possible. But, I mean, still, the bounds are still solid. It's just that the bounds are not saturated by any physical theory. Okay, so I have probably like 2 minutes, so I will just show you some pictures. So what we are doing now is a natural next step. Now try to not just look at one amplitude, 2 to 2, but to look at several and see if we get stronger constraints, like in the Ising CFT case, you even got some island, you could isolate a theory from doing that. Okay, so the simplest setup that we are looking at is again similar to the Ising case. We have a Z2 symmetry, so we have the lightest particle Z2 oz, and then we have another stable Z2 even particle. And then we have the continuum in each C2 sector. And we look at this set of scattering amplitudes. And so we went back to two dimensions, because even in two dimensions, this problem is already hard. I mean, I don't know how to solve it analytically. It's now several coupled functions of a single variable. And now we maximize a coupling which mixes the two particles. Okay, so the odd particle with the if. Okay, so okay, this is just a comment. It's like this is really different from what we had before. So since we maximize this coupling, this particle production, this particle change from particle 1-1 going to 2-2 cannot be zero, because this coupling appears here as a pole, so this cannot be zero. So actually, the full set of amplitudes is coupled together. Okay, I just, since I don't have time, and this is still work in progress, so you, actually, John gave a much more detailed talk about this in February here in PI, so you can watch the video if you want to know more detail. But the main conceptual difference, or one of the most important differences, is that now you have this structure of cuts. Okay. So suppose I'm looking at 2-2-2 scattering, so the, sorry, M2 particle scattering. So now the minimal energy I can have is 4M2 squared, because that's the minimal energy to have these two particles at rest. But the cut starts before, because there is a cut starting at 4M1 squared, because M1 is lighter than M2. So you have to impose, you can only impose unitarity as probability conservation starting from there. Okay? So the probability of 2-2 going to 1-1 plus the probability of 2-2 going to 2-2 is less or equal to 1 starting from there. But there is this small piece of the cut that starts at 4m1 squared to 4m2 squared, where this unitarity does not bound the function. So that would be a disaster. If you have a piece of the cut where you don't bound the function, the analytic function can do anything it wants. You really have to bound every cut. Okay? So that's solved by using something called extended unitarity. So in fact, there is another equation which is not just this simple probabilistic interpretation, but, well, it's still a natural equation, at least in the context of perturbative quantum field theory. Still, the imaginary part of the amplitudes of 2-2 to 2-2 is still related to the modulus of the amplitude 2-2 to 1-1 in this region of the cut there. Okay? And so what we are doing is to impose the full set of unitarity, which actually becomes a matrix equation in this set of amplitudes, and also this extended unitarity equations. And so we're finding stronger bounds than what we found before just for the single amplitude. So I still don't have lots to show you, but I can at least tell you that there is one interesting theory, which is this Potts field theory. So if you start from the three states Potts critical theory, so it's a minimal model, and you deform this theory by say the first relevant operator like going off the critical temperature of the Potts model, then you actually get a massive integrable theory which saturates our bounds. Okay? So that case actually gives the generate mass and gives a ratio of these two couplings, which is equal to -1. So if you fix that, which are the two parameters that we are varying now in our constants, we get the integrable theory. And so what we are doing now is to vary these masses by breaking this degeneracy and varying this ratio to study the neighborhood of this integrable Potts model. Okay? No questions? Okay.
Questions.
Yes.
The previous definition is a special case of this,
right? If I said MP equal to I2, then M equals
to I2. So this single amplitude bound that we derived also applies to here, right? You can analyze, say, 1-1 goes to 1-1, and use this same technology to find the bound here. But the point is that that bound will not be optimal if you look at these extra constraints. So that's maybe I was not clear. That was the point of this argument here. So the previous bound was this unitarity equation, right? This square less than 1. And we found a bound. But now that bound gave you some finite value of this coupling. But if you have a finite value of this coupling and you actually calculate this S matrix, this S matrix will have a pole proportional to this coupling, right? Because you can, I mean, this coupling also contributes to this S matrix. So this S matrix cannot be zero. So actually, the optimal bound we found can never be saturated. So this will make the bound stronger. So that's what we are trying to do by looking at more consistency conditions.
So the boundary of the region that you found previously to the left, the part that wasn't realized by Stein-Gordon?
Yes.
Is it excluded by this definition?
Right, so actually even Stein-Gordon escapes that because Stein-Gordon has more particles, as like M3 and M4, which don't appear, because these integral theories are a bit funny, right? So if you scatter 1-1 with 1-1 in Stein-Gordon, you get a pole of the next breather, but then if you scatter the next breather, you see more poles of like the third breather. So if this pole was not there, actually, Stein-Gordon could not realize that bound. So it's this third breather that cancels the contribution from this pole and makes this actually be zero. So integral theories are extremely fine-tuned. Like that's why the masses have to be so well fine-tuned. Okay, so I probably over time, right? So let me just conclude with a list of open questions. Well, I already mentioned this. There's some recent work on this putting flavor. It's quite interesting to describe ON models and in two dimensions. And I'll just leave this up. You can ask me questions if you're interested. Thank you very much.
What about unstable particles, poles on the second Riemann sheet? Do you have any?
Yeah, so this is this point, yes, yeah. Actually, there was a recent paper discussing that. So in 2D is quite simple because it's what we discussed before. So we have this equation. How should I explain that? So this equation is actually an equality, right? For, let me write it like that. This equation is an equality in between these cuts. So S of S plus I epsilon times S of S minus I epsilon is equal to 1. So S, the scattering amplitude, is the inverse of the scattering amplitude in the second sheet. So a pole in the second sheet is just a zero in the first sheet. So we can just impose that there is a zero here in the first sheet, and then we can bound the derivative of the function at this zero. Okay, so this is what this paper.
So in principle, you can look for resonances in pi by scatter.
So this is in okay. So this is in 2D. It's that simple.
Yeah, no.
In higher D, this is still true for each partial amplitude, right? For each of these SLs, it's still true. But so what you would do. And that's actually something we are looking at. We would start from our ansatz, which is crossing symmetric as a function of t, and then compute the partial amplitudes for each spin. And then if you want to have like a scalar resonance, you would impose that there is a zero in the first sheet of the S0. So that would be a constraint on our parameters. Yeah, so you could impose the resonance. Actually, a game that we are playing now which has some interesting results, is you could say the following. Well, this was the question. The answer is still a bit unclear how well it can work. But the question you can ask is, suppose you say the theory has a resonance, so it has a zero, say, in the spin zero sector, the spin zero partial amplitude. How free can the theory be? Because if it has a resonance, it cannot be completely trivial, because the S matrix has this zero, so it cannot just be one. But how free can it be? So we can take our ansatz and then, for example, minimize some integral of the total cross-section subject to the constraint that there is this zero. Okay? So this is some other kind of game that we're trying to play.
We choose the mass.
We choose the mass of the resonance here, yes.
And you choose also the weight, because it's the
exactly. We choose the old. Then we can study this question, how it varies when we vary the two things. Yeah. But as I said, I think there is still room to find better questions, more interesting questions, because I mean there's clearly a setup where we can parameterize S matrices and impose all the consistency conditions, so we can explore like limits of S matrices with properties that one wants to study. So for now we did like the most obvious thing to decouple.
Do you understand physically why the bounds you get on quartic couplings are much stronger than on cubic couplings? Just numerically, I'm saying.
Stronger, you mean the number?
It seems to me that the quartic coupling can be of order 1, but cubic can be much larger than 1.
That's
divided by 32 pi.
There was a 32 pi normalization there. Yeah, I don't know how to make sense of that. This actually, I mean, this was. This 32 pi was the normalizations these people were using.
So 32 pi is 100, okay.
So, how would you, is there a natural way to compare like the numbers between porting and cubic?
Yeah, I don't see. As long as they're all dimensionless. Okay, I would say very vaguely lambda over g square or something like that. But yeah, but it's a very naive comparison. Yeah, I don't know how to compare them.
Yeah.
Also, another question. When you were showing us the plot in 1 plus 1 for G,
the cubic G,
I think it was in a log scale, no?
Yes.
Okay, whereas the others in 3 plus 1 was in a linear scale.
Yeah, this was because since this really diverges here, I don't know, we plotted it.
Exactly. So before you get to the very divergent part, the gentle slope in a long scale, is it the same as the slope that you get in 3 plus 1 when you approach square root of 2? Do you compare the two results? Because here
you mean again comparing the numbers?
Yeah, or the function, the way you are approaching. Here you have a singularity, as you're saying, but I'm saying if you stay slightly away from the singularity, the slope is gentle in logarithmic scale, which means that maybe it's exactly the same as you get in 3 plus 1.
So, for example, here, close to threshold, so this you can, even in higher dimensions, you can get analytically, I actually put it here. From the non-relativistic limit, because in this case, in this limit, even though in the partial waves you have these crossed cuts which are hard to control because they only come from crossing, when this pole gets very close to this cut, essentially all the physics is dominated just by this region, and you can forget about that. So you again becomes analytic, and so you can predict this analytically. But the way, like the power at which this goes to zero depends on the dimension. Right? There was some, I can't remember exactly. I think in 4D maybe it was some square root, but this was dimension dependent. So at least in this region it the curves will be different moving from one dimension to another.
Is there a way to impose that your S matrix is that of a QFT coming from deforming a particular?
That's an excellent question. That's that's what I was trying to discuss here in my last point. So this would be extremely interesting because here we're just bounding, just imposing some IR data, right? A mass spectrum or something. So, well, there's two ideas that I put forward here. So one of them is hard scattering. But this I think only works in higher dimensions. So if you scatter at high energies and fixed angle, then at least the power law behavior. So if you do hard scattering in quantum field theory at high energy and fixed angle, the energy dependence, the energy decay of the amplitude is a power law, and the power is fixed by the UV CFT. Okay. This actually, I think, I don't know any proof. People found this for QCD, and then there's some paper by Polchinski and Strassler that does that in holographic context, and so relates this power with, actually, I think it's the leading twist of the operators that can create the external states. So it's something like that. So that would be one way if we could impose this hard scattering scaling, then we would somehow tell something about the UV we want. But honestly, I don't know how to make that work in the numerics because, first of all, it's a hard limit, like S and T and U all go to infinity and it's just depending on the ratios. So in our ansatz, the way it is now, basically, if you just go to infinity, you just get constants. I mean, there's nothing non-trivial in terms of angle dependence. So it would be one idea, but I don't know how to implement it. Another idea, which also I don't know how to implement, but let me speculate also, is to look at form factors and correlation function. So here, I only looked at scattering. Okay, I take states which are scattering states. I could also take states which are states created by local operators. Okay. And then I could look at the mixed system where I take inner products between scattering states and states which are created by local operators. So then I will have scattering states. With scattering states, I get S matrices. Scattering states with local operators, I get form factors. And then local operator with local operator, I get two-point functions. And all of that, again, has to be positive semi-definite in a unitary theory. And OK, if I have the two-point function clearly, I can go to the UV limit. And I very directly can tell what UV theory. But again, I don't know. I mean, that's an idea to explore. I don't know how to implement it so far.
Right. Why don't we take a trial again?
Thank you.